Look more drums.
Welcome to Midpoint Monday on 88.5 FM and WMNF.org. I'm Sean Canaan. Joe Biden is president-elect, but he lost Florida by more than a point. This hour, we'll hear four experts talk about the 2020 elections and what it means for the country and especially for Florida. We'll take your calls to see if you agree. Here's the number to join this conversation, 813-239-9663. You can also email DJ at WMNF.org. You can text 813-433-0885. The 10 Tiger Bay clubs from around Florida gathered online late last week to figure out the lessons that can be learned from the 2020 elections in Florida and nationally. We're going to hear part of that conversation this hour, and we'll take your calls as well. We're going to start with a question to the four panelists. What is the most important revelation that came out of the 2020 election process? Yvonne Fry is the moderator here. We're going to hear first from Mark Caputo. He's a Florida-based reporter for Politico. Then we'll hear Susan McManus, a voting expert and distinguished professor emerita at the University of South Florida. We'll hear from Steve Shale, a veteran Democratic operative, and from Ryan Tyson, a Republican pollster.
The most important thing in Florida is that the Democratic Party is in shambles, assuming it was ever really up and walking around and capable of taking nourishment. You know, they say in football, and pardon the sports analogy, the most important play is the next play. I look to the next election in 2022, and I think, my God, Donald Trump in 2020 won Florida by a greater margin than Barack Obama did in 2008. What does that say about Marco Rubio's reelection and Ron DeSantis' reelection? I think it bodes really well for them. There's going to be a national reckoning, and it's happening already, about whether to compete in Florida or not at all, whether Florida is a swing state or not. I don't think it's a swing state anymore. We've now been kind of bucked down to battleground. The debate that you're hearing in the Democratic Party is understandable. Where do we go from here? But I just wonder if their problems are multi-layered and almost too tough to fix. Starting with what they don't like to talk about, which is their voters. Their voters are unreliable. It's very difficult to win an election with an unreliable voter base, especially compared to the Republicans. And then secondly, the most important thing is candidates. And their candidates on the whole has just not been as good as the Republican candidates. And then comes things like party structure and financing and the like. Don't get me wrong, you need money to compete in an election. But when you combine all these factors together, you look at the amount of money that was poured into Florida and the final result, really makes me wonder how much of a red state we're going to become and how much more of one we will be. You're already seeing signs from Ron DeSantis of taking an increasingly conservative approach to things, including expanding the Stand Your Ground self-defense law to cover property crimes and property-related offenses. I think that's a taste of what's yet to come. I'm not sure if I went over my 2 minutes or not. I'd like if I had a shot clock, but that's kind of my first off-the-cuff thoughts on what I saw here in 2020.
Dr. McManus, what was the most important takeaway for you this election cycle?
It's underscoring an old message, which is that a great ground game wins elections. And you can see from the get-go that the disadvantage that Democrats had once COVID hit was the instructions not to go door-to-door campaigning and registering voters. And they had to suddenly defer to social media, virtual town halls, all of those things, while Florida Republicans didn't miss a beat. They kept going door to door, social distancing with masks, and asking people to register. And they, of course, closed the gap in the registration between the two parties, but also canvassing them to find out what big issues were on their minds. So I think that's an old lesson that was really vividly played out here is too much reliance on social media is still not going to be a really solid personal contact ground game.
Thank you, Dr. McManus, and welcome to you. We appreciate you making the time to be with us today. Steve Shale, welcome.
Yeah, I mean, listen, the most important thing in this election cycle is Joe Biden's going to be president. I mean, that's the biggest thing that happened this cycle. I mean, we're going to have a new president. By the landslide margin that Kellyanne Conway described their last win, Joe Biden's going to win 306 electoral votes. He's going to win, you know, probably 80 million popular votes, and is going to have the second largest win of a non-incumbent president since FDR. I mean, that's a big deal. And, you know, I think there's a lot of self-loathing going on in my party right now. Anybody who thought the beating Donald Trump was going to be easy was completely not paying attention to reality. And, you know, there are a lot of things that were exposed in the select selection on my side. Some of them self-inflicted, some of them structural, as Mark said, and we can get into that. But it's a hell of a lot easier to fix that stuff when you have the president of the United States. And Joe Biden's win is a, you know, to quote him and Obamacare, it's a big effing deal. And so I think in the end, like, you know, yeah, I mean, we can happily talk about Florida and talk about structural stuff in my party. But in the end, the biggest thing this election cycle is Donald Trump will not be president and Joe Biden will be.
Thank you. Welcome. You're pretty clear on that. Ryan, welcome to you, Ryan Tyson. What was the biggest takeaway for you in this cycle?
I'll say two things from my perspective. Number one, for my party, the Republican Party this cycle finally got better at using data to direct field, which results in turnout. Dr. McManus referred to that. I like to tell a lot of folks from my vantage point, we basically tried to copy the 2012 playbook from Obama. Register voters, build on the enthusiasm that we could see in our data that existed within the various demographic subgroups that we would exploit that enthusiasm with, and then turn them out to vote. So I think that's a big deal for my party, that if you think about the beginning of the century, early 2000s, getting into the mid 2000s when we were getting beat by Obama two times, we know that media is important, but we've gotten a lot better at field, a lot better at ground. And I think that's a big deal for my party moving forward. The second thing I would say is this. Yes, Steve is right. Joe Biden will be the next president of the United States. Yes, it's going to be 306 electoral votes or whatever that comes out to at the end. But I think it's also important to remember that just like in 2016 and just like in 2012, the margin in several of these states is very, very close. If you take Wisconsin, Arizona, and Georgia, you're talking 45,000 votes differentiate the two candidates at the top of the ticket. If there's better field in those states, if there's a couple of atmospheric conditions that go differently, you now have a 269-269 tie. So I would just say that, yes, Joe Biden's going to be president of the United States. I think his only mandate is not be Donald Trump. And I think that's evident by what happened down ballot all across the country, specifically in the Congress. Washington Post saying that we're probably only going to have a four-seat majority difference between the Democrats and the Republicans. State legislatures, Republicans picked up three of them heading into a redistricting cycle. Eric Holder didn't win a single race, a single state that his group played in leading up to this cycle. So I say yes, they won the big prize, but I also say we are a very divided country. If you get just a little deeper than this top level, you can see how close this thing really is. And there's no way to predict how the next 2 to 4 years are going to look, in my opinion.
Well, that was Republican pollster Ryan Tyson. Before him, we heard Democratic operative Steve Shale, USF professor emerita Susan McManus, and Politico Florida reporter Mark Caputo. You're listening to 88.5 FM WMNF's Midpoint Monday. I'm Sean Canaan, and we're looking for new callers to call in and then share your thoughts with the election. If you agree with these political commentators, or if you disagree, give us a call, 813-239-9663. You can also email dj@wmnf.org or text 813-433-0885. Well, the next two questions that were put to these panelists have to do with whether Florida is still a swing state and whether polls are accurate.
I'm actually going to answer it this way. I'm going to let Mark Caputo answer that question for me. Go ahead, Mark.
Ryan's been good about this, and he points out it's how you read a poll that really makes a difference. Yes, the polls do miss certain demographic groups. Good pollsters, and I'd put Ryan in that group. I'd put him in the group of the best pollsters because he was one of the people throughout the 2020 election cycle who, because of 2018, I trusted. And I kind of ignored a lot of these big public polls. Now, even Ryan's own poll toward the end showed a little more of an advantage for Biden and wound up obviously taking place in Florida. And what a good pollster does is know how to read the poll and how to know when what the data is saying and what it's not saying. Now, you can take a top line, and this is partly a media problem, and I'm in the news media, and spin a story of like, oh, it's a 49-48% race. a good pollster will tell you what it means. And I think pollsters do need to do a better job, not calling out anyone here specifically, in their sampling methods and techniques and continue to improve upon them. The news media needs to do a better job, and I would include myself in this category, of how to report those results. And I think out of the soul searching that we in our industry loves to beat itself up and then resist criticism at the same time, that's one of the things that that I, as a reporter, I'm going to try to do better at doing. I did better in 2020, but at the same time, I was still subject to looking at all these public polls and you know, being tugged partly that way and then tugged the other way by good pollsters like Ryan.
And I would also add to that, too, never trust a survey you didn't pay for. That's a motto we have in our office. Steve's agreeing with us on that. And I would just add to your questionnaire, we saw what was happening in Miami-Dade from the very beginning. Our final Miami-Dade survey showed the president only down 9 points. He lost Miami-Dade by 7. We had the president up consistently 2 points throughout the final closing weeks of the election. Our final sample got a little too far left of center. We didn't want to weight it. And it showed that Biden had strengthened. But when we analyzed the internals, we thought that the president was going to win Florida by 2 points or more. So, no, I disagree. I think public polling is done. I don't think there's a problem with private polling whatsoever.
Thank you. Dr. McManus, what did you see on the polling front this cycle?
I look at it differently from what impact it means in terms of voter behavior and candidates. First of all, a really interesting study was published this year by some political science scholars that looked at long-term what happens when one party is leading by so much for so long in terms of turnout. Does it hurt that candidate's supporters because of complacency? Or does it hurt the candidate who's behind because people just give up? And the answer, very definitively and conclusive, was that it hurts the candidate that's in the lead. And I think that you could see some of that in the Florida turnout issues among Democrats. But secondly, and this is just as important, it can also hurt candidates. And there were a number of candidates who lost in Florida that complained bitterly that their internal polls were showing them up by 10 or 12 points. And that affected how they campaigned and the urgency of what they did to alter their strategies. So these bad polls can have an impact on both voters' behavior and also on candidates.
Thank you. Steve Shale, would you round this out, the discussion on polls?
Yeah, I mean, listen, like Ryan, I've been a pretty loud critic of public polling in Florida. I once got in a fight with the Quinnipiac University that was so obnoxious that the Columbia School of Journalism actually wrote an article about it. So, I mean, I you know, and I mean, fundamentally, this is a problem, and I'm not blaming Mark, but the media views public polling like crack. They can't help themselves. If they see names and numbers next to them, they're going to print it. And all these organizations understand that, and they realize it doesn't really matter how good a poll they put out or not. Somebody's going to report it. Somebody's going to get to go on TV and talk about it. And so, you know, and most public polling is done, as Ryan knows, it may be 1/10, 1/20th of the cost of what folks like he and I will pay for a poll. It's the equivalent of, you know, any product you're buying, it's a really cheap product. It's not often scientifically based in anything, and it's mostly just trying to make news. And so, you know, I don't think polling is dead in any way whatsoever. I mean, I found out, you know, recently the Biden campaign had them down 1 going into the election here. I mean, yeah, that's kind of right in the margin. But these public polls are just, unfortunately, they become more about organizations getting coverage than they are actually being informative.
If you don't mind me adding, one of the things that we did at Politico, and I certainly did, which I didn't do in the past, is didn't put numbers in headlines anymore. And we backed away quite a bit from doing that horse race poll-based coverage because, you know, I'd been kicked by that mule a few times and just wasn't going to do it again.
Yeah, let me say one more thing, too, that's a problem in our state, is people from outside of Florida do not really recognize the language diversity in this state, the impact that our age structure has on polling, and using broad categories that really hide some very important subgroups. A perfect example would be the Latino vote, which was very different by country of origin, and yet a pollster from outside of Florida is inattentive to that kind of information. They should do their homework a little bit better before they poll a big, diverse state like ours.
Agreed. We're going to move on to our next question. Thank you
Well, that was Susan McManus, who is with USF. She's a professor emerita with USF. Earlier, we heard Mark Caputo, a Florida-based Politico reporter. We heard from Steve Shale, a veteran Democratic operative. And we heard from Ryan Tyson, a Republican pollster. You're listening to 88.5 FM WMNF Tampa. This is Midpoint Monday. I'm Sean Canaan. It's 12:21 in the afternoon. And if you'd like to join this conversation, we're going to go back to the panelists in just a second. But if you want to join this conversation, the number to call in is 813-239-9663. You can also email dj@wmnf.org. You can text 813-433-0885. I'm trying to find out if people agree with the analysis that they're hearing or if they have something that they disagree with. Paul out there in Tampa says, I'd like to hear people speak about how our country can try to repair the rift between so many of us, regardless of how this election wraps up and what is next. So if you have an answer for how we can repair the rift, Paul would like to hear from that. Of course, all of us would like to hear that. Paul says, thanks for supporting the community and giving various viewpoints and an opportunity to speak out. Let's hear from on the phone. Let's go to Stephen in Sarasota. Hi, Stephen.
Hi, how are you, sir?
I'm doing great. What's on your mind?
Well, I want to do a very interesting, what the panelist said. It sounds like the typical sort of self-flagellation that occurs after elections. We lose, and that's fine. But let me suggest something else here. I think the bigger issue in this country today, I happen to be doing some research in preparation for a talk I'm going to give on militias in the United States. And what I found in my doing my research was this is the outcome. Militias are essentially an externality of people constantly believing conspiracy after conspiracy after conspiracy, combined with good old-fashioned racism, misogyny, homophobia, you know, all the other things that seem to just plague human beings. But this seems to me to be a sort of mental epidemic crisis that we're in this country.
And we're going to talk later in this analysis. We'll hear the people talking about how rumors are spread on social media and how disinformation is spread on social media and what we can do about that. So I appreciate you bringing that up.
Well, one last thing I did want to bring up is the recent, I'm sure you are already well aware of this new social parallel universe being formed by the Mercers called Parler. Okay? So if they can't get their message through on Facebook, which is hard for me to believe, frankly, they're going to create their own little biosphere, you know, self-contained, just like Fox, and people can go there and constantly satisfy their confirmation bias all day long. And I'm really beginning to wonder how much tolerance can the nation have for hate speech, for insane propositions built on the idea that the Democratic Party is a cobble of pedophiles. I mean, how much more of this nonsense do we have to take as a nation?
Yeah, we had a plot against a governor of a state to kidnap the governor of the state, and who knows what next with her.
Yeah, and they were going to try her and probably execute her sort of like ISIS style. I kid you not.
Yeah. All right, Stephen, thanks so much. Keep us posted on what you find out about the militias.
I will indeed, sir.
All right. Thanks so much for your call. If you'd like to join the conversation, the number is 813-239-9663. You can also email dj@wmnf.org. You can text 813-433-0885. You're listening to WMNF Tampa, 88.5 FM. This is WMNF's Midpoint Monday. I'm Sean Canaan. We're listening to some panelists, four experts on elections in Florida, talking about the 2020 election, finding out what happened during the 2020 election. What are the takeaway messages, and we're going to go right back to them in just a minute. Let's take another call right now. We have Shang in Lakeland. Hi, Shang.
Hi, how you doing, sir?
Doing just great. What's on your mind?
I heard the last call, and I kind of agree with him, but I don't believe that the problem is because of the conspiracies. I feel the problem has always been because of the truth. Once people find out what the truth is, then it's easy to say conspiracies of it's easier to try to break a lie apart once you add more lies to it. So it causes conspiracies or whatever. The problem is because a lot of people know the government, be Republicans or Democrats, are against the people. There's no two parties. It's one party against the people.
So let me pause you for a second there. And in the context of the last call, we were talking about disinformation campaigns that are going out over these, kind of fringe social media things. And it's things like that because the governor of Michigan wants to protect people by putting in a mask mandate, for example, that person needs to be kidnapped and put on trial. You're saying that the people who are plotting kidnapping are, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but you're saying that they know the truth, and the governor who is trying to protect the population by putting a mask mandate, they're just against the people. I'm saying that
the government is lying, and if you only know half of the truth, that's just as bad as a lie. If you talk such as Columbus discovering America, then you find out that, hey, Columbus never even came to America. Then you have those people who's going to believe that Columbus discovered it, arguing against the ones who find out that he never came. Then there'll be conspiracies or people arguing about the truth instead of the truth being the truth. Just let the truth lie on its own instead of lying long enough, letting the truth become a lie. You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah. All right. I appreciate that. Thanks so much, Shane. Thanks for bringing that up. 813-239-9663. We're going to go back to the panelists now, but if you are calling in now, we'll come back to you in just a bit. But thanks to people who have called so far. And, I think that having a way to have truthful information out there, fact-checked and so forth, I think that's really important. So I think that's what you were getting at, Shane. So thank you for calling in. And we're going to go back now to these panelists. They were part of a statewide Tiger Bay online meeting. We're going to hear from Mark Caputo, a Florida-based reporter for Politico, Susan McManus, a voting expert and distinguished professor emerita at the University of South Florida. We're going to hear from Steve Shale, a veteran Democratic operative, and from Ryan Tyson, a Republican pollster. And we are, this segment of the question that they're going to be answering is whether Florida is still a swing state.
For the discussion on that, the next question is from Mark Proctor, a Republican from the Tampa Tiger Bay Club. He asks, is Florida still considered a swing state? Some national commentary has suggested that Florida is now a red state. We touched on this earlier. Steve Shale, would you care to elaborate how you feel about that?
Yeah, I think Ryan said something a minute ago, which was right, which is like, it's just hard to know what the next 2 to 4 years are going to look like anyway, in any way you look at it. I mean, you can make the argument, and I certainly did back in, people made this argument after George Bush won Florida by 5 points, that Florida was not a swing state. Nate Silver wrote a whole article about it. 4 years later, Obama won Florida by 3 points. In the intermediate 4 years, Democrats won 3 of 6 statewide elections, picked up 10 seats in the legislature and 5 seats in Congress. And yeah, I just think, again, there are some structural things, as Caputo said, that benefit Republicans. They have more certain voters than we do. They have more likely voters than we do. My party's not registering voters this year had an impact on the outcome. But, as I've said before, I wouldn't argue. I would not dispute it's a lean red state. But again, I think that we got to be, I think if we've learned anything in the last 10 years, it's not to take any too big a lesson from any one election cycle.
Thank you. Dr. McManus, what do you think? Are we still a swing state?
I'm going to give you two answers. Republicans say absolutely not. We've won. We've gained seats in the congressional delegation and legislative on the governorship forever. The Democrats say, yes, we are. And they have a right to say that. A lot of their problems in this election, frankly, was just the way the campaign was run. And so that's remediable. So I think the bottom line is that most people still look at Florida as a swing state. And you look at our registration. And in terms of the expectation in this election that we would be a swing state, nothing proved it more than the fact that we received the most money spent on TV ads of any state. And we also had the most candidate visits in the 11th hour of the campaign when it mattered most. So, yes, if you're a Democrat, you still think we're a swing state. You can fix it by fixing your campaign. No, you're a red state if you're a Republican, and look at all the accomplishments at the state and congressional level.
Thank you. Ryan, what do you say about this one?
We are a swing state. Any Republican that remotely thinks that we are not, I would love to spend 20 minutes with you and I can convince you why. I think candidates still matter. All it takes, in my opinion, is for the Democrats to nominate a historical figure like an Obama, and immediately he can put back the demographics necessary to be successful in this state. I believe that we've seen a change in the kind of people who've moved in here as the economy got better, somewhere around 13 and 14. We could see the kind of whites that were moving here and where they were moving and how they behaved politically and how they're now helping to swing elections. But who knows what the next 2 to 4 years are going to look like. And I'm adamant about this because candidates still matter. I believe what Donald Trump was able to do with Hispanics in Florida, and we know it wasn't isolated to Miami-Dade. We all know that now. There was improvements in Broward and definitely improvements in Osceola County as well. But that was candidate-driven on both sides. And I think anyone who believes that when we move into this next midterm, that candidates still don't, that they think that candidates don't matter, I would say that's wrong. And I think everybody would be shocked that the Democrats could be very much competitive, depending on a couple different factors going either way. I'm a Republican, have been for my entire life. I just feel like the demographics of this state don't lend us to be able to be out of the woods and say you're either a lean R or whatever. There are intangibles that would lead you to say that, but I still think that things could change really fast on a moment's notice, and I don't expect that, depending on, you know, historical kind of candidates, and by the way, Trump was that in Florida, as Obama was as well. I feel it's dangerous for my party to think that we're now a lean R state, in my opinion.
The only one here. Yeah, no, we're not a swing state. We're a battleground. Yeah, and I understand I'm drawing a distinction here. My thing is this. You're a swing state if you swing. The record is what the record is. Well, 2014, Republican wave. 2016, Republican wave. 2018, Republican wave. 2020, Republican wave. I mean, at what point are we going to start just admitting, you know, we are what we are? I agree with Ryan that great candidates make a big difference, but this, like, all it takes is Obama. I mean, that guy was like a fantastic candidate, almost like invented in a lab. And Trump was actually to a degree as well, a media lab. So yes, great candidates make a huge difference, but in a state as big as Florida with 10 media markets, where, you know, it can cost $3 million a week to get your message out statewide on television, and Democrats already worried about plowing more of their precious resources into what's become a graveyard for them, it's difficult seeing the state swing again. It's possible. Let's see the candidates. But until then, battleground.
Well, that was Florida Politico reporter Mark Caputo. Before him, we heard Republican pollster Ryan Tyson, Democratic operative Steve Shale, and USF professor emerita Susan McManus. You're listening to 88.5 FM, WMNF's Midpoint Monday. I'm Sean Canaan, and we're taking your calls right now to find out if you think these panelists, if you agree with what they're saying, or if you disagree. The number to call in is 813-239-9663. You can email dj at wmnf.org. You can text 813-433-0885. Jerome writes, I'm so sick of the new conspiracies. I wish impeached President Trump would have made America great again with the good old Loch Ness Monster, Sasquatch, and aliens. This deep state stuff is wearing and it lacks entertainment value. So there's Jerome complaining about the disinformation that's out there. Chip in Tampa says the secret to winning elections is actually no secret at all. Run a progressive agenda beneficial to the majority of Americans, Medicare for all, tuition-free college and trade school, shrinking the defense budget and a jobs program, and our policies that voters would overwhelmingly support. Well, do you disagree with Chip or do you agree? Let us know. 813-239-9663. You can also email dj at wmnf.org. You can text 813-433-0885. Chris in Clearwater, you're on the air. What would you like to say?
Well, Sean, on the web, unless you operate your own website servers, you have to build on rented property. So we might as well choose the most reliable and most responsible, most pro-expression landlords. And that comes to social networks, search engines, video hosting. And I find that over the years, anybody of any political persuasion, doesn't matter who you are, as long as you have some opinion, you're going to get banned, a shadow banned, or have your platform removed, your account deleted without often without explanation or any kind of warning. No three strikes rule is observed, like YouTube claims to, but they often don't. So
Chris, I know where you're going with this, and I just want to pause you for a second. I really hate to interrupt you, but do you think that that happens to the New York Times? Do you think that the server of the New York Times has to shut it down and say, you guys are lying too much, you're being harmful to the broader community, so we're going to shut you down? Or does it only happen to groups that are putting out disinformation that is potentially harmful to a lot of people?
I don't understand. You ask, do I think that social networks shut down the New York Times platform, or
for example, okay, sure, yeah, like let's say if the
New York, are you talking about the New York Post?
No, I'm specifically referring to reputable news organizations like the New York Times or NPR or CBS News or something that, if, in general, put out information that that people can rely on. They don't get censored by Twitter or by Facebook, and yet you know you're giving me examples of people who put out this. It sounds like
Let's go with what people can say. I don't know about that. I don't know about the New York Times having been ever censored or threatened, but I do know that people just posting CDC data because the CDC contradicts itself on several different pages of its own website. If you just cite CDC data, I've seen people getting banned. And just websites that report on, say, realcurrencies.wordpress.com, for example, if you want to find any conspiracy theories there, anything that might you suspiciously be posted there, I would love to hear that. But that goes into economic policy, and that's banned for some reason. I know several other websites. I won't make a whole list of them, but I've experienced it over the years on Facebook. And that's why I'm going over to other social networks. I have a long list of them. There's gab.com. There's minds.com, which is also very popular. There's Parler, which I have yet to check into. But yeah, people are networking. They're getting, that's why Facebook is losing so much market share over the last several years. Millions of hours of user time is do a search on Facebook scandal. You'll find several scandals having nothing to do with them banning people. And, you know, those who criticize others who believe in conspiracy theories like the caller didn't mention one example, and they conspicuously neglect to mention conspiracy facts. So folks who want to think for themselves as courageous enough to expose and fight against corruption, which are almost always based in conspiracy.
I'm actually going to move on. Chris, I appreciate it. I think you made your point. And
out of hand deny that any...
I appreciate that. You made your point. I'm going to move on because I've got a lot of callers on the line. All right. Thanks for that. And let's move to Paul in Valrico. Hi, Paul. Thanks for calling in. What would you like to say?
Oh, listen, I'm a registered Democrat, and I vote the straight Democratic ticket every time. I voted for President-elect Biden. And I feel like I'm okay if the Republican Party wants to destroy itself, but I think the Republicans are making a strategic error if they assume everybody that voted for Trump is going to vote for them, for the Republicans, when they run. Because I think there's 70 million votes, roughly, that Trump got. But I think only about half that 70 million is real dyed-in-the-wool Trump people. A lot of Republicans that I know only voted for Trump based on taxes. They didn't like him, but they're just afraid of Biden for higher taxes. And I think a lot of those people aren't going to vote for Republicans that are running on a Trump ticket. They're tired of it. And I think we're going to pick up a lot of Republicans in these next rounds. So does that make sense?
I appreciate that input. Thanks for that suggestion. And that might apply even to perhaps even Georgia in the coming weeks. All right, thank you so much, Paul. I appreciate that call. I appreciate everyone who's on the line right now. Please hold, because I do want to go back to hear more from our panelists, because I want to refocus this on the recently completed election, because I think we have a lot of lessons that we can learn. So we are going to hear the next two questions that are going to go to our panelists, and I'll remind you that we're hearing from USF Professor Emerita Susan McManus, Steve Shale, who's a Democratic operative, Republican pollster Ryan Tyson, and the fourth one is Politico Florida reporter Mark Caputo. The next two questions have to do with the Florida Constitution. First, whether it's a contradiction that voters added an increase in the minimum wage to the state constitution while they also voted for Trump in Florida. And the next one after that, that we'll get to in just a bit, is the failed Amendment 3, which would have created a top two open primary in Florida. So here is the minimum wage and Floridians voting for Trump on 88.5 FM WMNF's Midpoint Monday at 12:41 in the afternoon.
Well, obviously, if you look at the patterns, if you at the vote, you could see that the rural part, the panhandle, was the part of the state that voted no on that. But the rest of the area of the state was pretty supportive. And I noticed right off in the coastal areas and the more affluent parts of the state that you saw a heavier vote for that. And that could come from two different ways. I haven't really looked at it as carefully as I can't look at it. No one else can either, really. But for a lot of the wealthier people that have moved into Florida, and just some native Floridians as well, looked at that as an example of where something needs to be done and to draw people to work in those areas and so forth. And also, if you live in one of those kind of areas and you're really suffering as a middle or low income person, you're going to be supportive of it as well. So I think that a lot of the means and the concerns and the ability to pay, even among wealthy, are a bit more supportive because they recognize, again, not only is it helpful, but it also relates to the kind of workforce that can be attracted to the area.
Thank you. Ryan, how do you make sense of the juxtaposition of those two anomalies here?
Absolutely. Some context for that is take us back to 2004. Republican George W. Bush is running for re-election. He wins the state by 5 points, 380,000 votes, and the minimum wage law that we live under today got 71%. It's not uncommon for a Republican to win the state and minimum wage go. Why is that? Well, when I've done research on the subject, there's too many voters who just out the gate approach the subject of minimum wage and say, yes, it should be higher. They can't tell you what the minimum wage was, but they just felt that it should be higher. And I think what this amendment faced, and the reason why it got as close as it did, it probably could have gotten a lot higher, it's that, I don't know if everybody recalls this, did you see those bold letters at the very bottom of the amendment? That was from a legislation in Tallahassee back in 2019. That would require an economic impact statement be placed at the bottom of that ballot. If you all recall, it was a very strongly worded statement, and it's different from the fiscal impact statement that you're used to seeing on the ballots. This thing basically foretold that there could be tax increases locally, revenue reductions based to meet these new employment or these wage standards. I think that was the biggest reason why this amendment almost failed. There was not a lot of money to defeat this amendment. Obviously, the people who were going to be disproportionately hurt by the minimum wage going up, they had been disproportionately hurt by the pandemic. And then also, you're seeing a lot of different retailers, big box stores specifically, that have been moving that way by going more to automation, self-checkout, things of that nature. So first, just a basic answer, not surprising that a Republican wins Florida and it still supports the minimum wage amendment because we've seen it before. But I do think that it was a lot closer than people thought because, in my opinion, of that economic impact statement that was at the very bottom of that amendment.
Thank you. Mark, what's your take on this?
The Republican Party is heavily a party of, even in Florida, where there's a lot of retirees, working class voters. Working class voters work, and a lot of them work in minimum wage jobs. And for some of them, they're able to kind of have their cake and eat it too. I'm going to vote for Donald Trump, who I like, who represents some of my cultural values, and hey, I'm going to get a minimum wage increase. So it's not that surprising. I mean, you saw the same thing with medical marijuana. There are Republicans out there, even though the Republican, let's say, apparatus, for loss of a better term, was against the medical marijuana amendments, a lot of people realized it was just good policy. You know, voters, you know, behave in interesting ways, but sometimes in very predictable ways. And when there's something concretely in there for them, they're going to approve it. Like, you'll see the same thing with local referenda on tax increases in conservative areas, and they pass. Well, why do they pass? Because the voters there look at the amendment there or the referendum, and they're like, oh, hey, this actually benefits me. I know where my money's going. I'm going to vote for it, even though I'm generally anti-tax. Same thing here. I'm a working class person. I'm tired of being paid $8.75 an hour. I should be paid $15 an hour, especially now that my CVS job, even before this, was being surplus due to what Ryan pointed out was automation. So it's not that mind-bending for me. The most surprising thing for me was how dumb Joe Biden was in his campaign in not wedding himself to something that was very popular. Like, you know, if you've got something that's going to get at least 60% approval, you should advertise it, especially with Biden, who is in favor of raising the minimum wage. You didn't hear anything from his campaign out there about it.
Steve Shale.
I think we all assume that somehow voter behavior must be tied up and down the ballot. Right. And I think, honestly, we've now seen like 8 cycles in a row where the evidence is that voters are separating all these conversations. I mean, Democrats thought minimum wage, as Ryan said, in 2004 would help them win Florida. Republicans thought putting an amendment to ban gay marriage in 2008 would help them win Florida. Didn't work. Democrats thought that the marijuana stuff would help them. Most outside observers thought that the Democrats, that the felons restoration of rights stuff in 2016 being on the ballot would help Democrats. I'm of the position until an amendment actually shows that it impacts the top of the ticket, we just need to stop assuming that and recognize, as Ryan and Mark and Susan have all said, that voters are able to differentiate these questions in ways that I think we often think they don't.
Thank you. We're going to leave it at that, but we're not leaving Amendment 2. This next question is from Nancy Granda, a Democrat. She asks, in what way do you think the Florida legislature might impede the implementation of Amendment 2, the amendment to raise the minimum wage? Steve, would you start with that one?
You know, honestly, I haven't put a whole lot of thought into that at this point. I mean, I'm certain that there will be efforts in the implementation to be very specific in the types of jobs and whether or not they can limit businesses. I mean, I don't, I mean, honestly, probably, you know, Ryan is probably closer to that than I am. You know, I'm certain that the legislature will try to put guardrails around it. But honestly, I just, you know, I'm still a week out from a presidential and I haven't hardly got my brain around mowing my yard, let alone that question.
Man.
Ryan, can you help us with this one? What do you think?
I have absolutely no clue what may be in the minds of the legislature. I'm not a lobbyist, so I wouldn't know. Sure, there may be something, but it seems pretty cut and dry. I don't know how you get around the schedule that was in that amendment, but then again, maybe they'll try.
Dr. McManus, do you have any thoughts on this one?
Sort of like Steve, I've been inundated of late, but one thing that you do know that needs to be explained to people that wasn't adequately done, this increase doesn't occur immediately. It's phased in. And I think that a lot of voters didn't recognize that they're not going to instantly get this raise that they had anticipated.
And Mark?
Yeah, I'm with everybody else. I think if the legislature can water down the will of the people, it will. Now, how will it? I don't know.
I don't know that I heard everybody else say that, but we'll leave you with that as your last word. We'll move on to
We heard from Mark Caputo. He was a Florida-based reporter for Politico. Then Susan McManus, a voting expert and distinguished professor emerita at the University of South Florida. We heard from Steve Shale, a veteran Democratic operative, and from Ryan Tyson, a Republican pollster. We also heard moderator Yvonne Fry there. And you're listening to people, a panelist talking at a Tiger Bay Club meeting a few days ago about post-election 2020 and what it means for Florida. And we're also taking your calls and your emails about what you think and whether you agree with these panelists. We're looking for new callers, especially if you want to call 813-239-9663. This is WMNF Tampa's Midpoint Monday. I'm Sean Canaan. You can also text 813-433-0885 or email DJ at WMNF.org. It's 12:49 in the afternoon. Simon writes, he sent a link to an article and he says, New York Times equals fraud. And he says, Sean, you are not news. This is your opinion. So thank you for those thoughts out there, Simon. Also, 863 area code writes, I just wanted to say that Republicans are not people we should work with. They will never work with us. They've been brainwashed by decades of pro-American nationalist propaganda, and Trump is the natural result of that. So that's the 863 area code text's opinion out there. We can go now to the phones, and we have Carlos in Tampa. Hi, Carlos. What would you like to say?
Yeah, it's easy and simple. The talk radio show, what's so-called conservative, it's a business. It's a business that is bringing trillions of dollars, okay? And basically, it's a brainwash. And I agree with Chip, the first caller. So if you go to the, city areas, you will find a lot of Democratic, a lot of people that they know what they are doing, a lot of people with, educated, more than high school diploma. You go to the rural area, and that's, I'm not saying 100%, but that's the majority. That's the kind that listen to those talk show radios, and they're limited and naive, and they absorb anything to tell them. I mean, the biggest problem that Biden is going to have, most of people of the Trump supporters, they won't put the mask on. So what do you do in this case? This is the first challenge. When you have people, they don't believe in science, and just because of Rush Limbaugh telling them not to put the mask on, and you have millions of people not putting because. So, I mean, this is scary. This is more than brainwashed. And at the other, at the other end, these media companies and advertisement companies, they are making billions of dollars of these. I don't know if you listen to Newsmax, yeah. And you will see. It's so scary what you hear out there. You know what I mean? That's all I can say.
All right. Thank you so much for that call, Carlos. I appreciate that. And if you'd like to join the conversation, we're going to hear a little bit more from the panelists right now, but then we'll go to the calls afterwards. 813-239-9663. Actually, before we go to the next group of panelists, or the same group, but answering a different question, Tony in St. Petersburg writes, my takeaway is to be appalled that over half of Florida voters and 47% of Americans as a whole would vote for a con man who followed up COVID, helped only his friends and family, not the country, and has lied to us at every turn. That's not to mention his authoritarian tendencies. So those are thoughts from Tony in St. Petersburg. Well, right now we're going to go to two questions about the balance between freedom of speech and dissemination of false information on social media and what the major parties should learn from the 2020 election. So this goes to what we were talking about earlier. Again, we're going to hear from Mark Caputo, a Florida-based reporter for Politico, Susan McManus, a voting expert and distinguished professor emerita at the University of South Florida, and from Steve Shale, a veteran Democratic operative. Oh, also from Ryan Tyson, a Republican pollster. This is WMNF Tampa.
I guess I'm a little purist on this one. My first reaction is no. Maybe I have too simplistic and yet too complicated a view on the problem with disinformation, but ultimately the problem is one of belief. This country has a crisis of faith and a crisis of belief. And that kind of manifests in the fact that so many of our fellow citizens want to read that Joe Biden is part of a cannibal pedophile cult. I don't know how that can be cured by censorship writ large. Now, we are seeing the First Amendment work in that people have the right to espouse the crazy stuff that they espouse as long as it's not dangerous. But the social media companies are also exercising the same care to a degree, or they're exercising care to not allow that to foster and fester as much on their platforms. But I think our problem is not with our rights, or even with those who seek to abuse those rights, but that we have such a large population that wants to believe this stuff. And maybe it's a problem with our education system to begin with, where people don't understand how to read news anymore or how to see it. But I think it's deeper than the First Amendment. That having been said, I'm in the business that the First Amendment kind of enshrines. And yeah, it's troubling when we have a population that's as large as it is that wants to believe fake news over real news.
Thank you. Steve Shale, what are your thoughts on the fake news?
I don't know. I mean, I probably find myself pretty aligned with Mark on this. You know, obviously it's the stuff that, like the QAnon stuff, which is way too mainstream and is, I think, honestly, a real threat in a lot of ways. Trust me, my Twitter mentions sometimes are all I need to know, and I'm sure Mark's are too, that there's some people with some really crazy and unhinged views of the world that are, you know, own guns and, you know, make you want to hide your address where you live. That being said, I mean, in the other part of my life, I do a fair amount of mentoring of young political leaders in the developing world. And in a lot of those places, like, speech is attuned to potential death. I mean, you know, I mean, I've, like, in the Philippines, there's about 100 elected officials who are extrajudicially killed every year for things they say. And so, you know, I think that, you know, it's a really slippery slope to start going in and trying to dictate what is speech and what isn't speech. I do think, again, both political parties, I'm going to say my own as well, I mean, like, need to do a better job of calling out BS, and they need to stand up to it. They need to be able to still be able to back down. I have no problem with privately owned social media companies pulling stuff off that is, you know, and labeling things. That's fine. But I just don't know where you, like, what's the line? Who's the arbiter? And I think that's where it starts getting dangerous.
Thank you. Ryan.
I've long believed that that social media, which I'm not great at, other than showing what I'm barbecuing that weekend, I've long felt, though, that these platforms have been a vehicle that the most extreme elements of our society are able to be louder than they would have ever been, and it's also helped factions of them organize in a way that they never would have been possible had these platforms not come into existence. Having said that, it's free speech. It's their right to be there so long as they're just publishing this content. I think it's very sad that with freedom and with the ability to have the First Amendment comes great responsibility. It's sad that a lot of our fellow Americans, both parties, they're not responsible as they should. They're not responsible adults. My own mother has sent me things that she's had on her Facebook, and I'm like, Mom, don't you realize that a Russian agent probably created that? It's very sad, though, that that's what we're seeing in our society today. And I would also add, it's very sad that these tech companies are making billions off of essentially a platform that's divided this country. It's unfortunate, but I don't think it can change. I really hope that we get a lot more responsible. I think it's sad whenever you look on Twitter and they feel that they have to nanny state everything. On the one hand, people should be responsible, but on the other hand, they have to nanny state everything with warning labels. I can't wait till that gets off of my social media feed. So I'm a little bitter about it, honestly. I don't like what's happened in our country, and I think that social media, I've said this to Mark many times, I feel like social media is a big driver of that because, again, it's the fringes that social media gives such a disproportionately loud voice than they would ever have.
Yes, thank you. Dr. McManus, last word on this.
Well, as a person who went to college in the 60s, I am a strong advocate of freedom of speech, and I see a lot of evidence of it being repressed in many different venues, and it very much troubles me. But education is one of the keys to helping with this misinformation. We know for a fact a lot of people don't know the basics about government or who's responsible or all of that. But also what you've seen is an inattention to the fact, and my colleagues here have all mentioned it, people no longer rely upon the traditional news sources that older people do. As our country has generational replacement and the younger generations come along, they get their news sources from vastly different places and their political news from vastly different places than we did, my age. There's also a tendency to look at traditional news sources where a lot of people, they've gone to these other venues because they see bias in the traditional news sources. And if you're not in step with that, partisan bias in particular, you're going to look elsewhere for your voice. And a lot of times misinformation is spread and reliance upon it because people do not feel their voices are being paid to attention to whatsoever.
Thank you.
Well, that was USF Professor Emerita Susan McManus. Before her, we heard Republican pollster Ryan Tyson, Political Florida reporter Mark Caputo, and Democratic operative Steve Shale. They were part of a statewide Tiger Bay forum, and it was moderated by Yvonne Fry. And you're listening to WMNF Tampa. There's about a minute and a half to go. I wish I could had time to call to take another call. I probably don't. Let me read this quick email from Marcy. She says, my understanding is that the Republican PACs put $4 million into Pinellas Hillsborough County spreading disinformation on the women Democratic candidates. The Republican PAC flyers and commercials had the same wording. They just changed the picture of the Democratic candidate. why doesn't the Democratic Party step up to defend their candidates is what Marcy is asking. She says, typically the Democratic candidates are grassroots candidates and they cannot compete with the Republican PAC money that's being used against them. So thank you for that email. And thanks to everyone else who emailed, called, and texted today. I apologize if I didn't get to you. If you're on the phone right now, you're welcome to leave a voicemail, 813-238-8001, extension 114, I think my extension is. You can just ask for Sean and leave a voicemail there. Thanks to Alvaro Montealegre and Frank Knox for their help in the show today. I'm Sean Canaan. Tomorrow at noon, your hero, Mark Bureau, will host Midpoint Tuesday. And I will post a video of this whole forum on our website, WMNF.org, because I didn't get to play the whole thing. Stay tuned now for Latino 54. That's coming up after NPR headlines on WMNF Tampa, St. Petersburg, Sarasota, and Lakeland. Thanks so much for listening. We've got to.